Now for our final story, La Vie en Rose. Stanford Storytelling Project senior producer Natasha Ruck shares a memoir about the fraught relationship she had with her grandmother. Natasha takes us on a journey from France to New York, from the present day to the 1930s, and through breaking into song, she takes us from confusion to understanding.
I imagine that for most grandparents, singing to a grandchild is an act of love. But for my grandmother, it was an act of war, and I was the enemy. I grew up in the north of France, near the Belgian border, and when I was 7 years old, a Belgian singer gave my grandmother her weapon of choice, a song titled Natasha. The song tells the story of a little girl named Natasha. When she's born and her Russian parents realize she's not a boy, they are dismayed. What a catastrophe, they sing. Nyet, that is Russian for no. Nyet, nyet, nyet. No to Natasha. We don't want a girl. We want a Nicolas. Now, my mother's parents were Russian, and my name is Natasha. So I hated that song. Singing that song to me was like pouring molten lava in my ears. I was 7 years old, and that year, Mémé, that's how I called my father's mother, Mémé would sing that chorus to me every time I visited. Grande catastrophe, grande calamité, fille trop timide, fille trop délicate, garçon solide, c'est grand et c'est gras. It's not that I was a horrible child. For Mémé, the problem was that I was a girl. For Mémé, girls were nothing. She called girls pisseuses. In French, that means bedwetter, except Mémé did not mention any bed. Girls piss. That's all they're good for. Mémé had given birth to 3 boys, and that was the right way to do it. When I was growing up, she had 5 grandsons that she doted on, but there were also 2 granddaughters, my sister, Aurelia, and me. Visiting Mémé was torture, but my sister and I found ways to cope. Mainly, we tried to get to Mémé's stash of chocolate. My grandmother loved chocolate, and she kept endless supplies of Côte d'Or bars and Leonidas pralines. But what she loved even more was to use her chocolate to play mind games on us. Once, I went to visit my grandmother on my birthday. I must have been 13 years old. I'd come alone hoping to get a present of some sort. As soon as I walked in Mémé's kitchen, I spotted a gift on the windowsill. I knew from the golden wrapping that it was a pound of Leonidas chocolate. So I looked away and hid my smile. This visit would not be in vain. Mémé asked me if I wanted some water. But I knew it was more than a simple question. There was a certain ritual I had to follow. As far as I can remember, my grandmother would always welcome me the same way. She'd be in her spotless, gigantic kitchen, towering over me like a white-haired, silverback gorilla. She would ask me what I wanted to drink, and offer me a choice between dry vermouth or water, and I would say, "I'd like some water, please." And she would reply, "Water is for ducklings." Now, hearing that phrase, "water is for ducklings," was unbearable. Mémé always said that, and she said it every single time. She said it to me, to my brother and sister, to my dad. She said it if you chose the water, but she also said it if you chose the vermouth. Whatever you said, she would always say, "Water is for ducklings." So on my 13th birthday, I walked in my grandmother's Lysol and cinnamon-scented kitchen. I was offered a choice between water and alcohol. I picked the water. My grandmother called me a duckling. Then she wished me a happy birthday. I knew better than to show my longing for the chocolates. So I sat at her giant kitchen table and talked about school, all the while hoping there were white Leonidas pralines in the box. The box remained on the sill. It got dark. It got time to leave. Stalemate. As I was putting my coat on, I went for it. Mimi, what's that box on the windowsill? I said. Then she said, oh, that's a little something for your cousin Anthony. I looked at her face, her high forehead framed by the coarse white hair, the light grey eyes with the metallic sparkle, and she smiled, and I knew she had bought the box exactly for that moment, and she knew I knew. That made her smile some more. That game of pettiness was pretty much how all my visits to my grandparents went. The years flew past, my grandfather passed away. I moved to another town. My grandmother moved from her four-story house to a two-bedroom condo in a large apartment complex. I moved to the United States and settled in Brooklyn, New York. And when I would visit home, usually once a year, I only went to see Mémé because it made my father happy. And when I was there, I would try to collect some sort of gift. Maybe a chocolate bar or a birthday/Christmas check. But one summer, the game changed. I'd been in the country for a week, and I dropped by to visit Mémé. As I stepped inside her home, I scanned the place. Most of the furniture she used to own is now crammed in this two-bedroom apartment. The carved ivory table, the Louis XV style couch with its faded rococo golden trim, they all feel cramped and crowded. I follow Mémé into her kitchen. It's a tiny, tiny room with a light green formica table propped against the wall. It can sit two, one facing the window and one facing the wall. The usual smell of cinnamon and Lysol is gone. Mémé asks me what I would like to drink. I opt for the water. She says, water is for ducklings. And she hands me a glass of water. I look at the glass. It's almost caked with calcium deposits. We move to the living room. I sit on the hard-as-bone couch, and as I sip my ritualistic glass of water, it gets to that moment. The moment with elderly relatives when you run out of small talk and you're both a bit too silent. I look at her and she looks at me, and we both look away. Her nose is just like my father's, only her skin is ashen. Her forehead is as tall as mine, and I feel like there is so much that could be said, should be said. I say, it's really cold today. She answers, I don't even have a little piece of chocolate for you. I say, next time, knowing I have no intention of seeing her again on this trip. I glance sideways at my watch. I've been here for less than 5 minutes. So I stare at the life-size photographs of all my male cousins, and I begin to imagine what this place must look like in her mind. Mémé clears her throat. I look back at her and she's frowning. She has this kind of absence in her gray eyes, and she says, do you want something to drink? And I raise my glass of water, and I say, well, water's my poison. And she answers, water's for ducklings. And while I listen to her say, water's for ducklings, I wonder if I have entered my own private version of hell. But then, I realize that my grandmother's brain has basically rebooted to my arrival. I've been there for 6 minutes, so basically, Mémé has 6 minutes worth of live memory. She's like a 1981 Commodore 64, or something with less than 16 kilobytes of RAM. That day, before I duck out, Mémé calls me a duckling 3 more times. When I finally leave, I make it to my parents' house and tell my sister. She confirms that my grandmother now has the attention span of a goldfish. But Aurelia tells me she figured out how to handle this. She tells me to just ignore the present and have Mémé talk about the past. It's actually kind of nice, Aurelia says. She really spills the beans. I'll show you. So a few days later, my sister and I go back to see Mémé together. And Aurelia is right. Mémé has the funniest stories about the 30s. Stories about stumbling into a gay bar in Spain. Stories about falling head over heels for her best friend's boyfriend, a mysterious Jewish boy, and seducing him. I'm astounded to realize the exotic Jew she describes turned out to be Pepe, my grandfather. Then, Mémé tells us that before she met Pépé, she was almost engaged to another man. Her sweetheart, she calls him. My sweetheart left me, she says. He left me to join the army. Mémé tells us that her sweetheart was stationed on a submarine, and that he died when the submarine sank. My sister and I have never been so entertained in Mémé's house. But when we leave her, we wonder if it's safe for Mémé to stay on her own like that. We ask my father, and he tells us that putting Mémé in a private home would be a death sentence. And he's right. He's a doctor. He's seen this happen with his patients. But he knows this would actually be worse for Mémé. My grandmother is a fury of a woman. As long as he's known her, she has set the rules in the family. She made everyone bake apple tarts like she did, and clean as often as she did. The only person who resisted her was my mother. No one could bully my mother. But Mémé bossed her husband, her three boys. She was so hard on her boys. She wanted them to be the first in the family to go to college, so she pushed them hard, sometimes literally. The one time my Uncle Paul came home drunk, she pushed him to the ground and sat on his chest, slapping him across the face until he sobered up. So, I get what my father is saying. Mémé doesn't quite live in the present anymore, but she should stay where she is. My visit ends, and I fly back to Brooklyn. While I'm away, my father tries to keep his mother in the crammed apartment as long as possible. But one day, she goes to the bakery. She wants some milk, which they don't have, but she doesn't believe them. She knows there is a cow behind the counter. I'll milk the cow myself, Mémé says. To get to that imaginary cow, my 91-year-old grandmother wrestles the baker to the ground. You don't mess with Mémé's food. Luckily, someone knows my dad and calls him. The next time I see my grandmother, she has been placed in a nursing home. But it's not really a nursing home. As we drive to the hospital, my dad says, "You'll see, it's a very good place." As we approach, he grows quieter. When we walk in, I hear the doors behind us lock from the outside. My dad points at the card-activated security system to me. Brightening up, he says, "She's escaped twice. Once, she made it to the street." As we walk through the hallway, we pass many patients/inmates seated in their twin cells. They stare at us uncertainly. We find my grandmother in a small courtyard. She has shrunk in size. Her hair has taken a yellow hue. She's wearing the old distended flower print cotton shirts that I remember used to hug her buxom figure. Now she looks more like a live orangutan than an alpha gorilla, but she's still got game. My grandmother is sitting at a table with her roommate and her roommate's family. The family brought a box of candy. Mémé is eating some. Today's a good day. Mémé recognizes my dad. "My son the doctor is here today," Mémé says, taking a page from the Jewish side of the family that never quite accepted her. Then she looks at the mousy old lady sitting next to her and asks, "What is it that your son does again?" The old lady closes her box of candy. "He's in sales," she admits, defeated. My father is pointing at Mémé's ankle. "Show her your thing," he says to my grandmother. That's when I see the gray band just above Mémé's drooping sock. My grandmother is wearing an electronic ankle monitor. "That thing actually rings if she steps out the door," my dad says. My father is proud of his mother's ankle monitor, of her willfulness. But he knows as well as I do that stealing her roommate's chocolate and looking down on her roommate's son can't make up for the fact that Mémé's life is miserable. I can only imagine how she hates being here. She hates the orderlies, hates being told what to do, hates the sterile, uncluttered environment around her. But worse, she does not understand why she is here, or what kind of here this here is. My dad is asking her if she knows who I am. And I see her eyes go fuzzy. She looks at us and she frowns. We've been here for 6 minutes. I guess she can't quite remember who we are now.
But Dad says, she's my daughter, so she is your granddaughter, the one in America. And Mémé looks at him, and she says, you're way too old to be my son. My dad laughs. Mémé has been sitting next to me the whole time, but she has come and gone. And while I listen to my dad laugh at her jab, I wonder what it must be like for her to wake up every 6 minutes in this world. I imagine that in her mind, everything is fuzzy and looks wrong. She tries to make sense of it, but she can't. She's like a coma victim waking up on a futuristic hospital bed after 60 years of sleep. I imagine her seeing this world around her for the first time. There are all these contraptions, and she can't fathom what they are. Transparent flexible tubes, strangely resonant surfaces, and natural fabrics. Worst of all, everyone around her is so old. Their skin sags and white whiskers sprout out of their ears and noses. But she, in her mind, she's a young woman again, perhaps in her mid-20s. She has just escaped her parents' farm in Belgium. She's escaped her mother and made a life for herself in France. She has snatched her best friend's boyfriend, that Jewish boy with the sensuous lips, and she does not care that his sister call her a shiksa. It is spring 1938, and she is not ashamed that she lived with him before he married her, and that she was pregnant when he said, I do. She looks around the courtyard, but her husband isn't here. Instead, there's this old grizzly bear of a man pointing at her ankle and smiling. What does he want from her? Do they know each other? What kind of sick, twisted humor prompts him to tell her he's her son? What with that gigantic hairy nose and that spittle on his drooping lower lip? He puts this strangely square object in her hand. The object is black and it crinkles to the touch. There's something hard sealed inside. The old grizzly bear of a man takes the crinkly black square from her. She reaches for it, but he slaps her hand. Then he quickly puts something back in her palm. It is unnaturally cold and smooth against her skin, but as she clutches it, it leaves brown streaks on her flesh. Eat it, my father says. And at first, Mémé resents the order. But then she kind of remembers something. She isn't quite sure, but she puts the mini Mars bar in her mouth. It's chocolate, you dummy, my dad says. And I feel really sad, because my dad, he loves his mother, but he's just a guy. Worse, he's a guy raised in the 40s in a country devastated by war, by a brutish mother. So he doesn't know what to say or how to take care of her. She didn't have any daughters, she had 3 boys, so there is no one to buy her new socks, no one to dye her hair, or even buy the blue-tinted shampoo, the one that would get rid of the yellow streaks in her hair. There is no one who can help the neat freak that she was retain anything feminine or neat about her. And the only way my father has to show his love is to marvel at her will to escape and to give her chocolate. So he keeps feeding her little Mars bars. At first, I'm angry at my dad, because he could be giving her the Côte d'Or bars she liked so much, or Leonidas pralines. But no, he is giving her this crap American candy bar. He could be touching her hand, but he just stands there, utterly lost. So I decide to make the best of the visit, like my sister and I always did. I don't just let things happen, I encourage them. If my grandmother thinks it's 1936, fine. If she thinks it's 1948 and that I'm her husband's cousin, the one who married a GI and moved to America, fine. I ask her questions and she tells us the stories she remembers best. They're stories my father never heard. Stories I've never heard. At 5 p.m., I tell her I have to go back to my GI husband, and she asks if she can come with. I think I finished my work for the day, she says. Another year passes. And another year. I go with my father to visit my grandmother one last time, but this time my sister joins us. She has devised a new mechanism to cope. The new method is a kind of banter, some sort of vaudeville call and response act the three of them play. My grandmother doesn't remember much now, not even the past, but she's still somehow herself trapped in there. so my sister and my father tried to find ways to bring her out. This time I joined them, and I joined the show. We're in my grandmother's room, with its two single beds separated by a plastic curtain. My grandmother is seated on her bed. Her roommate is there, too. The roommate has aged a little better than my grandmother. She's mesmerized by our arrival. My father points at me and asks my grandmother, "Do you know who this is?" And Mémé looks at me, and I can see in her face that she knows this is a trick question, that she's supposed to say yes. But she does not really know who I am. I see her nod, but really she looks at me, and it's like the first time she sees me. My long hair, my high forehead. I imagine that, maybe, I look a little like the girl she used to be. In her mind, I look like the girl she thinks she is. The girl who wanted to go to school to be a school teacher. The girl who instead had to go work in France to earn money. Money to support her parents and her baby brother, Camille. Camille, the brother who had lied. Lied to me about my sweetheart. About my sweetheart who died in the submarine. My sweetheart who never wrote any letters. Except my sweetheart did write letters. Love letters. And Camille, my own brother, he knew. He knew, but he didn't tell. Didn't tell me that mother took the letters. Mother hid the letters. Burnt the letters. "Do you know who this is?" my father asks again. In the hospital room, my grandmother is staring into space, lost in some memory. So the roommate jumps in. "It's your granddaughter," she says, excited to have the upper hand. "The other one." And Mémé looks at me again. And I smile and I say yes. And Mémé asks me, "What do you do for a living?" I start to answer, but my sister cuts me off and says, "Natasha lives in America, and she's a chorus girl on Broadway." "You know, a chorus girl," my dad says. "She sings and dances on stage in her underwear." I'm beginning to get the contour of the character I inhabit in the new narrative my father and sister have concocted. They can't get my grandmother to remember who any of us are, but they can still get her riled up. Mémé likes to rant. They like to see her rant. She rants. Everyone's happy. So I forget that I'm a documentary producer, and I enter my sister and my father's game. I say, "Yes, Mémé, that's what I do." But I still have some dignity, so I add, "I'm an actress. I'm not always wearing a tutu. Sometimes it is a long taffeta dress with a big hoop. And anyways, people like the dancing, but mostly they come for the singing. Singing, after all, is what Carnegie Hall is known for." Against all odds, my grandmother does not launch into a rant about this type of girl, the one singing in their underwear because they don't have the wits to make a living. My grandmother, she sits up and smiles. She seems strangely proud of this. And then I notice that her roommate's mouth is agape. I doubt either of them knows what Carnegie Hall is, but the roommate is quite horrified. I say, "The crowds love me." And Mémé looks at her roommate. And Mémé looks at me with her foggy goldfish eyes, and she's beaming with pride. "Your hair is pretty," Mémé says, which is perhaps the first compliment she's ever paid me. Her shaky hand reaches out towards me, and she touches my hand. Our hands clasp. But her roommate is not buying it. She's fuming. "You're lying. You are no singer," she says. "Why would I lie?" I answer. "Singing is my life." Then the roommate says, "Sing something." I look at my father and my sister. They are loving this. I look at my grandmother, and she looks at me with those wide blue eyes like a wind-swept cloudy sky. I love singing, and I've been taking singing lessons to get better at it, but I'm borderline tone deaf. Yet there is this one song I sing at the underground Romanian Jewish karaoke steakhouse, provided I've had enough vodka. And so I clear my throat, and I start. Des yeux qui font baisser les miens, un regard qui se perd sur sa bouche. Voilà le portrait sans retouche de l'homme auquel j'appartiens. And this incredible thing happens. My grandmother's face lights up, and I can see her consciousness rolling out there in the distance. It's gathering momentum, it's gathering speed, and suddenly She sets foot on shore and she starts singing.
Quand il me prend dans ses bras, qu'il me parle tout bas, je vois la vie en rose.
And I listen to that helpless, thin little voice. And I remember all the times I was helpless in my grandmother's care, the chocolate she dangled in front of me. I remember when she would hum the Natasha song while doing the dishes and feign innocence when I cried. And I listen to her voice as it begins to weaken. And I lent her my voice. We are both of us singing in unison, and she looks at me, with perhaps not love, but joy, because she knows the tune, she knows the words. But once she's not startled, she knows what's coming next.
Il est entré dans mon cœur une part de bonheur dont je connais la cause. C'est lui pour moi, moi pour lui dans la vie des mots d'amour. Je vois la vie en rose.
Des mots de tous les jours et ça me fait quelque chose. Il est entré dans mon cœur une part de bonheur.
When you kiss me, heaven sighs, and though I close my eyes, I see love in your eyes.
When you press me to your heart, I'm in a world apart, a world where roses bloom. And when you speak, angels sing from above. Every day words seem to turn into love songs. Give your heart and soul to me, and life will always be.
The story you just heard was written by Natasha Ruck. Music was composed by Owen Callery. Visit our website to find which performances of La Vie en Rose he drew from.